Hello and welcome to Value Driven Data Science, brought to you by Genevieve Hayes Consulting. I'm Dr. Genevieve Hayes, and today I'm joined by David Schreiner-Kahn to discuss making the leap from employee to entrepreneur. David is the podcast host and community builder from Smashing the Plateau, an online platform offering resources, accountability, and camaraderie to high-performing professionals who are making the leap from the corporate career track to entrepreneurial business ownership. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Genevieve. It's great to be here.
Data science is among the most high-demand skills of the 21st century, with opportunities existing for data scientists to make a difference and earn good money as an employee in a wide range of industries. Yet, there has also never been a better time to be an entrepreneur. But for data scientists who have never experienced the entrepreneurial life and who are used to the security of a steady paycheck, making the transition from employee to entrepreneur may seem like an impossible leap, regardless of how desirable it may seem. Helping people to make the move from employee to entrepreneur is something that you, David, help people to do through Smashing the Plateau. So to begin with, David, how did Smashing the Plateau first come to be?
Well, Genevieve, first of all, your description resonates with me personally because it's also my story. I was an employee for the first 28 years of my career. I started my business in 2006. I had never been an entrepreneur before that. And I actually made the transition quite abruptly. Many people make it much more gradually and more gently than I did. But that was 17 years ago, now almost 18. And I'm still here. I'm still in business. I'm still working and still paying the bills. So it can be done. And Smashing the Plateau evolved both by design and by circumstance. So in my case, I went from my last job was in the nonprofit sector. I was an executive. I was primarily responsible for the finances and operations of the agency that employed me. And I started my business as a nonprofit management consultant focused on helping organizations with their finances and their operations. That was what I knew best. That was my network. That was my world. And I was off to a good start. I did start to get clients fairly early on. I wasn't fully booked the first day that I was in business, but by the end of the first year, I was doing fine. And as time went on, I looked around at other consultants that I thought were ahead of where I was and were in places, you know, where that I aspired to get to. And I started looking, okay, well, what are they doing that I'm not doing? And in particular, they were visibly creating content. And in those days, you know, we're talking like 2010, 2011, they were mostly writing blogs or producing still print newsletters. And there were some email newsletters, but not like it is today. And so initially, I thought, you know, I wanted to be more visible and start to create an audience. So I started a blog, and then the blog turned into a podcast, which is now pretty long running. We're about to enter our 10th year. And my business also started to shift. I started picking up some business clients from mostly small privately held businesses. And I was still serving nonprofits, but I'm going to say less and less of my business was the nonprofit sector. More and more was the privately held business sector. And among the privately held businesses, I started getting requests from solopreneurs, people who were consultants or coaches who had businesses like mine and wanted some help to try to grow their businesses. And over time, between the content creation and the podcast and people that I was interviewing and larger portion of my client base, I became personally really drawn to help people who are leaving corporate and trying to run and grow their own businesses, Because what I saw was, like in my case, the reason I started my own business was I wanted more control over my career, more control over my time. I wanted more control over who I served. So basically, I wanted to do more of what I love and get paid what I'm worth. And I, you know, over time felt more and more compelled to help people that just wanted to do great work, doing what they love, doing what they're competent at, and make a reasonable living doing so, so that they're able to support their lifestyle. And I have found that there are ways that people like this can accelerate the journey and can do better faster. As I'm sure you know, being an entrepreneur is not necessarily a slam dunk. It's not so simple in many ways. And we, you know, I'm sure we'll talk more about this. In many ways, being an employee can seem easier. I certainly succumbed to that for the first 28 years of my career. But there's nothing quite as rewarding as being an entrepreneur when you can get it to work so that it serves your needs.
Yes, I would agree with that. Are there any common factors you've noticed with regard to, say, employment background or demographics of the sorts of people who come to you for advice and assistance?
Yes, there are definitely some demographic patterns. So I would say the most common thread in our audience is significant work history. So typically 20 to 40 years in corporate. Somebody who's 25 and in the early, very early stages of their career, they typically haven't experienced enough of corporate culture, and particularly the toxic part of corporate culture that affects people that are, I would say, more mid to late career. So yeah, so I would say work tenure is a big part of our demographic. And also, there's a mindset commonality, which is a strong desire to make things work on your own terms.
I'm guessing a lot of people who come to you would have been let go by their previous employers or ended up in a situation where it was just they had to leave because there was no other choice. Is that right?
I'm going to say it's a mixture of people who get pushed out, who leave voluntarily because they've kind of had it with what they've experienced. And there are people, we have people in our community that are working full time, getting a paycheck and doing something entrepreneurial.
Okay, that's interesting.
So there are some that they see that, you know, particularly, you know, let's say you're 50, 55 years old and you're in good health. The likelihood that you're going to want to work and probably need to work for decades into the future is there, right? So if you're, you know, let's say you're 55 and you think you're going to work until you're at least 75, that's another 20 years. And if you feel like you have kind of maxed out your growth in corporate, that stagnation is going to eat at you. And so even though you might not be in any jeopardy of being pushed out and you might be adequately compensated, you know that you need to do something so that you don't find yourself when you're 65 suddenly out on the street, because the longer you wait to start something entrepreneurial, the harder it may be to kind of get it off the ground.
Are the people you deal with mostly executives, or is there a mixture of executives and non-executives there?
It's a mixture. And I would say they're most commonly professionals. So we appeal to knowledge workers, right? So these are not people in manufacturing who are actually like assembling goods. They're not blue collar workers. They tend to be white collar professionals who have at least college degrees, if not higher level degrees, or some kind of professional certification. These are smart, well-qualified people who work hard, do good work, but they realize that corporate life is not the best thing for them for the next, let's say, decade plus.
What you've just described there is the typical data scientist. What I find interesting with data science, so many people go into data science because they want to build models and make a difference with data. But if you look at your typical data scientist's growth trajectory. You've got your data scientist, they go to university, they graduate, they get a job with big corporation, and start doing the stuff that they want to do, which is building the models. But then they get to a point where the ladder that they're on cuts out, and in order for them to keep growing financially, they need to go onto the managerial ladder. And that's often taking them away from exactly what it was that they set out to do. And they can either remain doing technical work under a manager or climb up the corporate ladder themselves, which is not what they want to do. And that can happen very early in their career. So I think going the entrepreneurial way and finding a way that they can keep doing what they want to do is something that a lot of data scientists think about but don't know how to do.
Well, that was actually my early career trajectory as well. I studied engineering. I have a master's in chemical engineering from Cornell, which is a great degree from a very good school. And my career trajectory was exactly what you've described, which is go to work for a big corporation, because big corporations hire a lot of engineers. And particularly when I graduated, it was commonplace to assume that if you're an engineer doing good work and you're in a big corporation, there are lots of opportunities to move both laterally and hierarchically up the ladder. And yes, management is one of the tracks. You can be a contributor as an engineer for a long time. But what I saw was, even early in my career, I saw that there were a lot of engineers that were getting pushed out in their 50s. They had sort of maxed out. Something changed in the corporate structure, and they were suddenly out. And there were financial consequences as well. And particularly in those days, different countries have different ways of handling the social safety net. But in the U.S., particularly in those days, the assumption was that you would work for usually 30 plus years. And if you were in the same corporation for the entire time, you'd be eligible for a pension. And I saw these guys that were getting pushed out, and they were mostly men in those days, getting pushed out in their 50s. And they were a little short of being fully vested in their retirement plans. And I was like, I don't want to be like that. And the aha for me came just after my second review in my second job, where I got a very strong performance review and a nice raise. A month later, I was out of work because the company that I worked for had lost a lot of business and they had to fire a huge portion of the staff. And my boss called me into his office. He says, David, I have good news and bad news. The good news is you're doing a great job. The bad news is you don't have a job here anymore. And that's when I started looking around at my career trajectory and thinking, I don't know that I want to do this corporate thing in this environment anymore, because I don't want to end up getting pushed out. You know, like at that point, I was in my late 20s. I don't want to get pushed out when I'm in my 50s and I'm have a mortgage and paying tuition, college tuition for my kids. So that's when I went into the nonprofit sector.
And you see it all the time in the newspapers, you know, thousands or hundreds of tech workers are suddenly out on the street because either the company's gone bust or they've outsourced the jobs to another country, or they're just cutting costs, like in the case of a Google or an Amazon.
A lot of that's going on right now as we speak.
Before, you're mentioning mindset, and that's something I'd really like to explore, because one of the things I've found from my own experiences is that one of the hardest parts about making the transition from employee to entrepreneur is making the shift in mindset. And that was something I was completely unprepared for when I set out on this journey. What I'm talking about is when you're in a standard employee type job working at a corporation or whatever, you've got that whole totem pole type relationship going on, where anyone who's more senior than you, you do whatever they tell you to do, and then you can instruct people who are below you in the totem pole to do whatever it is that they're meant to do. I think one of the things that is challenging to get your head around is that you no longer have that totem pole set of relationships. You're suddenly dealing with horizontal relationships. One author I was reading referred to it as de-bossing yourself. For someone who has spent, say, 10, 20, 30 years being in a bossed relationship at work, how do you change your mindset to deal with the entrepreneurial lifestyle?
Oh, it can be quite challenging. You know, you've kind of described it quite accurately, Genevieve. So you know, you go from a place where you're responsible for what you're responsible for, and there's a team of people both up and down the hierarchical ladder and also around you. As a data scientist, you're responsible for data science. You're not responsible for ordering supplies for the office. You're not responsible for HR issues. You're not responsible for making sure that the heat and the air conditioning works. And when you go out on your own, particularly if you are starting off as a company of one, which is what I think we're talking about here, you go from a place where, first of all, your work is prescribed, your calendar is full, you're busy all the time, you know what you're supposed to, what is in your lane, what you're responsible for, and you know that there's a team of people that will take care of all the other stuff. There's also this built-in social structure that provides the emotional support for you to be able to do what you do well and not have to worry about the other stuff. And in addition, as a data scientist, I'm going to guess that you're probably not responsible for marketing and sales.
Yes.
When you start your own business, all of a sudden that full calendar is now empty. Your overflowing email inbox is now empty. The social structure is gone. You spend all this time alone and you have no team of people to assign anything to. You have to take care of all of it, the stuff that you're good at and the stuff that you're not good at. And then you have to get up and market and sell something that you've never had to sell before as a business, namely yourself. And I find even people that are corporate refugees that come from marketing and sales roles in companies, it's very different to try to market and sell the company that you work for and then to try to market and sell yourself, because it's very personal. And part of the mindset is you've got to get used to hearing no a lot, because even when you actually get leads for business, they don't all convert into sales. They certainly don't all convert into sales right now. You've got to have a thick skin and realize that no doesn't mean, no, I'm doing a bad job, or no, I'm a bad person. It means that this potential client isn't ready to do business with me right now.
Also, what you're saying about marketing, a lot of data scientists tend to be more introverted, and marketing and sales is more of an extroverted type activity. And unless you're a grandiose narcissist, then it's probably going to be very challenging for your average data scientist to go out there, have conversations, and say, look at me, I'm the most wonderful person in the world. You should buy my services.
Yes, exactly. It'd be very challenging.
So how do you make that mindset shift?
Well, one way to do it is you've got to find your people.
Okay.
One of the reasons why I started Smashing the Plateau, and in particular started the community that is part of what we do, is I experienced how powerful it is when you hear from your peers feedback that will support you in these kinds of challenges. For example, if you are willing to share with your peers when you have a prospect for new business and you're working on a proposal, if you're charging too little, which I see happen way too often, if you're charging too little, your peers will call you on it, right? And if you're with the right peers, they'll do it in a loving, supportive way. And they'll say, you know, you're providing a much greater value in this potential contract than you're proposing. And here's a way to rethink it. So I've seen that kind of thing happen. Or when you're having conversations with prospects and suddenly you don't hear back from them, which is another thing that happens very frequently. And a common reaction is to take it personally and think that they don't want to do business with you. And most of the time, that's actually not the reason. It's more like other stuff has come up. Like they have a problem that they can't solve themselves, and they're having a hard enough time trying to deal with the fact that this problem exists and they don't have a solution for it. And then trying to find a consultant that can work on it and make a deal with a consultant is like an added piece of work. So they may be just be stretched very thin. It may just take them longer to work on their end of closing the deal. And again, your peers will talk you down from the ledge when you're thinking that, oh, you know, what was me? This is not going so well. And they'll say, no, just, you know, maybe you should just reach out again. They haven't responded to an email. Pick up the phone and make a phone call. Yeah. So I would say the biggest help is going to be being with the right people.
One thing I tell myself when someone doesn't respond to me, you know, the natural tendency for your average human is, you know, they hate me, I've done something wrong, et cetera, et cetera. One of the things I always tell myself is this person doesn't know me. In order for them to hate me, they'd have to know me. It can't be anything personal.
That's very smart.
And if they're speaking to me to quote for them, they clearly don't hate me either.
Exactly. And I can tell you, I've had conversations with prospects that have gone on for a very long time. I'm thinking of one that I was in touch with on and off for a year before they became a client, and they became a really good client, but it took a year of like constant nurturing the communication to get the deal done. And it was definitely worth it.
And the fact is, if they're willing to take your quote straight away without having further conversations, you've probably priced it too low.
Right. Yeah. If you never get pushback on your prices, you're pricing too low. You should be getting some pushback on pricing.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, if you charge $1 million for a $100 job, they're probably going to stonewall you anyway. But as you said, I think most people underprice rather than overprice.
Yes. Consultants for sure. Most people underprice.
You say that your primary audience are knowledge workers, and that fits in with data scientists very well. Is consultancy the main way most of your clients go into entrepreneurial work, or are there other avenues that these knowledge workers can use to create a business?
There are other ways. The vast majority, probably like 80 to 90% of our audience, they stay in the same field and they become consultants of some sort. We have a member of our community who went from being a practicing attorney to work in the health and wellness field as both a coach and a leadership development expert. That's a shift. It's not a shift for him personally because he was actually doing this concurrently with being a lawyer, but it wasn't a business. Right. So it was taking something he was really good at and he loved and creating a business around it after he just stopped practicing law. But I would say like that's the exception rather than the rule. Most people go from being a data scientist in a corporation to being a data scientist as a consultant.
What would that potentially look like? Because, you know, I'm thinking of this from the point of view of someone who's worked every day of their working life at Big Corp, building models or whatever. And they're now out on their own as either a single person or with a small number of partners. They would be going up against people like big four consultancy type organizations. How would you envisage someone like that framing their services so that companies don't just look at them as being this sole person and laugh?
Well, not every company is going to want one of the big four firms for a variety of reasons. Pricing is one. They're not going to get the same level of attention from a big four consulting firm that they're going to get from a solopreneur or a firm with a handful of people in it. So attention is a big issue. Customization, a big firm is probably going to be, I'm going to say, more cookie cutter in their approach. And also, smaller companies often don't have the budget that these big firms require, you know, because they're notorious for creating lots of meetings with lots of team members that cost a lot of money.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Right. And, you know, a solopreneur or a small firm is going to spend most of the time focusing on doing the work.
One thing I'd say from my experience is that if you're planning on going out on your own, it's probably best to focus on smaller self-contained projects initially rather than big year-long projects, because otherwise you're effectively becoming an employee again of, albeit of your client's organization.
I would agree. And yeah, the bigger long-term contracts take a long time to sell. And you do run the risk of having too many eggs in one basket if you're focused on just getting those big contracts, because how many of them can you actually handle as a solopreneur?
I would imagine that you'd probably only be able to handle two at the same time at most.
Right.
And that would be a challenge.
Right. So one of the things to think about, right, as an entrepreneur is Right. You have the disadvantage of not having the paycheck. So your cash flow is subject to fluctuation in a way that doesn't happen when you're an employee. But you also have the opportunity to develop multiple sources of revenue. So if one source disappears or gets reduced drastically, you still have other sources of revenue so that you can stay in business and you can keep feeding your family.
By multiple sources of revenue, are you saying multiple clients or by having something like doing consulting work and having, I don't know, a coaching business on the side or a training business on the side?
Yes, and all of the above. Any way, you know, whether it's different elements of your business model, like you could have consulting, you could have coaching simultaneously. We have a member of our community that is doing work primarily with one corporate entity, which is risky, but has developed relationships with liaisons in the company that have different budget lines. So if one budget line dries up, there's another budget line that's available.
Oh, that's interesting. So that must be a very big organization that they're working for.
It's a big corporation, right? So whatever you can do to diversify your revenue is going to make your business healthier.
It's basically the same principle as investing in the stock market. You don't want to just invest in one stock. You want to have that combined portfolio of a dozen or more stocks.
Correct. And when you're an employee, you are investing in one stock.
I read in one book, everyone is a small business of one. It's just the majority of people only have one client, and that's their employer.
Exactly. The other thing you have to think about, you know, when you do go out on your own, you know, we've talked about how you're responsible for everything. You can't spend 100% of your time doing work that's paid client work. You have to actually spend time running your business. So you do have to spend time doing marketing and sales and operations and relationship building and all these other things. You really have to devote time to it. Those things don't happen on their own.
One of the things I found when I was an employee, there'd be times of the year when your calendar would be completely full with actual real important work. And then there'd be the down times of the year where you'd have maybe 10 to 20 hours of real work per week and then all that excess time. So often during those times, my goal as an employee was, how can I keep myself occupied for 40 hours per week without just staring blankly at my computer screen? And so prioritizing tasks wasn't really a big deal then. Whereas since going out as an entrepreneur, one of the things I've found is there is always 40 hours worth of good, solid work to fill in the week. And then it suddenly became a matter of, how do I prioritize these tasks? Because some of them are going to benefit my business and others, it won't matter a crumpet if I don't do them at all.
You are so correct. There's always more to do when you're running a business. And you have to be really careful about how you prioritize your time. Yeah, you can always make more money, but you can't make more time.
When I first heard you speak, it was on Jonathan Stark's podcast, Ditching Hourly. And one of the things you mentioned in that interview was you were talking about sabbaticals. I found that idea really interesting because I'd previously just thought of sabbaticals as something that only academics did. Could you talk about how you envisage a sabbatical working in the context of someone transitioning from regular employment to entrepreneurship?
I used to think that sabbaticals were only for academics as well. And one of the things that I realized is there's actually a process to getting further along in the career journey where you're doing more of what you love and you get paid what you're worth. And I actually have kind of boiled it down to 5 steps. And the 5 steps are reflecting, where you're identifying what's most important to you, aspiring, where you're setting clear goals that will guide you way into the future, planning, where you're creating short-term objectives that are very specific and metric-driven that work towards your goals, right? The goals are the long-term, and then the objectives are very short-term and metric-driven. And then the last 2 steps are implementing and iterating. And particularly as a data scientist, I think you'll really appreciate the iterating part. But implementing is when you map out the activities that are going to help you achieve your objectives. And iterating is what you do on a very short-term basis. And I like to think of it as maybe setting an objective for 90 days and iterating 1 week at a time. I think a week is a nice cadence. I think there's a reason why humans have established that a 7-day week is something that's universal. We all, regardless of politics and geography, everybody in the world follows a 7-day week. Nobody fights over that, right? And so this, the whole idea of you create a plan, you take a step, you look at the results, you see what's working well and what's not working so well, and you make a small tweak in your plan for the next week, and you keep doing this. And if you do this long enough, you're going to see fabulous results. It takes a lot of discipline to do it, but that's the basics. That's the basic structure, these five steps. And the beginning part is very, as I said, the first step is reflecting. So in the beginning, you have to do a lot of deep thinking about yourself and what is really important to you and what will make you happy. And if you just jump into implementing and iterating, you're more than likely going to be going in the wrong direction. So the sabbatical is designed, and the reason why I like the term sabbatical is you actually need to take a break from what is causing you stress and what is kind of keeping you on this hamster wheel. And if you think about it, for example, in the 7-day week, whether you observe 1 day of rest, or maybe like most of the developed world has a 2-day weekend, the whole idea of the weekend or the day of rest is that we have a break from the day to day, which gives us a chance to sort of recharge. And you think about, for example, meditation is supposed to be a chance to recharge and kind of separate yourself from the stuff that is keeping you from doing what is most beneficial in the long term. So this, right, the sabbatical is designed to give you space to do some self-reflection where you can kind of recharge and decide what's really most important. And if you look at what your goals are going to be that will carry you for the rest of your life, you can't just do that, you know, in a few minutes. You can't do it while you're trying to take care of your kids or commute to work or do a high demanding job. You need time and space to actually do some deep thinking.
How long have you found that typically takes people?
It depends on how much space you can actually carve out to do it. Like if you're in a corporate job where you are finding it stressful and you feel like the environment is toxic, you're probably going to need at least a few months to kind of detox from that. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't produce income while you're on sabbatical. You don't have to stop your life. But what I think is important is if you can financially afford to take 3 to 6 months to not have to stress about how you're going to produce income, that would be great. I've had some guests on my podcast that have taken what they say, I've taken a year off, which, you know, they're really taking 12 months where they're not worried about how they're going to produce income. Many people can't afford to do that. But even if you take what is a short-term job or maybe a contract work that is, you know, is time limited and you know it's not going to be your main focus, so you don't have to really stress over it, it'll give you more space to do some of this deep thinking. So yeah, I would say 3 to 6 months is a good time frame to think about if you can do it.
What I'm thinking as you're saying this is, I don't know if you ever saw King of Queens, the TV show?
I have not, no.
Okay, there's this part in it where the main character's wife, Carrie, she loses her job and she decides to take a break before looking for a new one. And she has all these great plans of what she's going to do, but it ultimately ends with her spending all day lying on the couch watching TV. How do you make sure that the sabbatical doesn't devolve into something like that?
Well, again, if you connect with the right people, where you have some regular accountability and you tell the people in your, again, you could join a community like we have, you can do this with an accountability buddy. You could join a small group, and this could be, again, doesn't have to be something necessarily that you're paying for, but it needs to be something that you're committed to. If you tell other people that this is what my plan is. My plan is to go through this self-reflective process for the next 6 months. And here's what I expect to happen over each month over the next 6 months. And then you have a built-in reporting mechanism. You're going to be way more likely to actually complete the self-reflective process and come up with your goals and then be well set to launch something new at the end of this initial period. I would say connecting with the right people and having a structure to report regularly can be the key to not dissolving into a couch potato.
Would you have certain questions that you set yourself to answer? So, for example, what are my goals? And just, you know, have a day when you just think, okay, I'm going to think about that maybe for an hour each day for a week or something.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, the first two questions are what's most important to you? And for most people, I'm going to say it's like, yeah, usually like 6 to 8 major categories. It's probably not more than 10. Things like physical health, emotional health, relationships, financial health. And once you identify what's most important to you, you could write a goal statement for each one of those. And the way I define a goal statement is that it's an ongoing process that is not metric driven. So you're never finished. You know, for example, in your work, if your goal is around utilizing data to impact the world in a positive way, you could probably create a goal statement where I am spending my working time building models that utilize data. And if you have a particular area of focus that's really important to you, that you want the data to be able to impact the world in a positive way, you know, for example, climate change, you could talk about how you would love to be creating ripples through the use of data that spur political decision makers to make healthy decisions with regard to our environment. Right? That could be a goal statement. You could work on this for the rest of your life. There's always going to be more to do.
Then once you've got those goals, you would take those and map out your plan. So for example, if you had that wanting to use data to impact the world in a positive way, that would inform who your target market is, which would be people who are wanting to use data for social good, for example.
Correct.
Okay.
Right. And then, yes, you can break that down into measurable objectives that are short term. You can identify organizations that are doing the kind of work that you want to support. And perhaps an objective could be, I want to develop key relationships with 10 organizations over the next 2 years.
And then once you finish your sabbatical and start going out to the implementation stage, you would then be working out, okay, these are the 10 organizations I want to focus on. How do I meet people and build those relationships?
Exactly.
That's actually a good segue into another question I have. Many people, when they start their entrepreneurial journeys, don't have the big networks and don't have a track record of delivering results in the consulting space. And they're also still trying to figure out their product or service offerings. What advice would you give to people who are just getting started in building those networks?
Start a podcast.
Yeah.
You get to interview some awesome people.
I would agree with that.
Yes. Start a blog. Start writing. Reach out to people on LinkedIn and find people that you can follow, comment on their posts. LinkedIn is a great tool to develop relationships. If you identify a small number of people that you want to follow, you can follow them and start commenting on their content. Yeah, anybody who is creating content, you can follow and start to interact with them around their content. In today's world, I think it's, although it seems like everybody is super busy and it seems like spaces are really crowded, the way we interact because of content creation and social media, in some ways makes it easier than ever to try to reach people.
I would agree. I don't know how I would have started this business 20 years earlier before social media.
Yeah, I think it's easier than ever to start a business.
So suppose we've got someone who has heard this episode and thinks, okay, great, I want to go off and do the entrepreneurial thing. And they quit their job, start their business and get things started. how do they know if the, well, firstly, how do they know if this is the right move to make before they pull the plug on their job? But also, once they've started, how do they know if it's working for them?
Well, you could probably start your business while you're still getting a paycheck. That's one of the easier ways to do it. I didn't do it that way, but it's, I would say it's a lot easier to start a business in parallel while you're still getting a paycheck and try to build up your business income so that you at least have some proof of concept that is working. So that would be one way to do it. If another way is, one question I ask myself and I ask others, when you're faced with a situation that has kind of unknown risks, like you're quitting your job to start a business, you don't know how well the business is going to do, is what's the worst thing that could possibly happen? Answer that question, write it down. And then next question is, okay, so if the absolute worst thing happens, what will you do? I've had lots of guests on my podcast that have gone bankrupt, and I've had guests that have lost their homes. And by the time I was interviewing them, they had built a new business back up and they were doing just fine. In many cases, they were doing better than they were the first time around. So yes, things can go south and lots of businesses fail. But think about, what would you do if what you think is the worst case actually comes to fruition? And write that down, and that will help you with your plan.
I would also add to that, if you're going to be asking yourself what's the worst case that could happen if you became an entrepreneur, also ask yourself what's the worst case that could happen if you remained an employee.
Absolutely.
I think people underestimate the risk of remaining an employee for too long.
Yes. Yes. And you know, you could also create a decision matrix where you go through the whole process of, particularly for data scientists, right, where you're assigning different weights to different scenarios, and you could score the whole thing and decide which path to take based on the results of your decision matrix.
This is reminding me of those risk assessment matrices that we used to have to deal with when I was working my office job. You know, you'd have high risk, medium risk, and low risk, and high probability, medium probability, and low probability. And you'd assess how severe the risk was based on where it fit in the matrix.
Yes. Look, the most important thing as an entrepreneur is being able to sell, right? If you can sell, chances are, if you're a smart person, you can figure out how to deliver what you've sold. For most knowledge workers that I know, the harder part is the selling, not the delivery.
And is there any advice you'd give to those people on learning the selling part?
Just keep trying. Yeah, don't wait. Don't hesitate. Just try. Just know that you're going to get a lot of rejections and you may fail a lot. But if you don't keep trying, you'll never succeed.
And the fact is, I mean, I think about, you know, everyone is so afraid of cold outreach. But, you know, I've received several cold outreach emails about things relating to my podcast. And one thing I find interesting, as an entrepreneur, I feel nervous about cold outreach. But when I've received some of these cold outreach emails about things that I'm genuinely interested in, I'm actually quite happy to speak to the person who sent me the email because they're offering me something that would be of value.
Right. Particularly if they've done their homework. So I get the same kind of outreach, and I can spot in a nanosecond when somebody has actually done their homework, they've looked at our website, they may have listened to an episode, and they've written something that actually is very much tied to what the show is all about, as opposed to these very generic mass emails that mean nothing.
Oh yeah, I got one the other day where they were saying my videos are not trending on YouTube. And it's like, yeah, of course they're not trending on YouTube. I don't put videos on YouTube.
Exactly. Yes, I get those all the time. You know, we have a form for anyone who wants to be a guest on Smashing the Plateau. If you just go to our website, it's right at the top of the menu. If somebody actually takes the time to go to the website and sees that there's a form for guests and puts their information in, that's very different than a mass email where whoever wrote it has no idea what my show is about.
Mm. Well, it's like applying for jobs. You don't spam people your resume. So we're getting close to time, but one last question. What final advice would you give to data scientists who are considering making the leap to entrepreneurship?
Well, Genevieve, no surprise, I've already said this a number of times, and obviously I'm a big believer in this, but join a community. Perhaps join more than one because every community has its own culture and personality and will serve your needs differently, but it's really important. I personally have been a member of communities my entire life, and I've always found them to be super beneficial. I was just having this conversation with somebody today who's starting a new community, and I said, you can tell how valuable a community is to you when you're going through a distressing time. It's like when times are good, you might actually not need the community a huge amount, but being present and being a giver in the community is really important, because when you need to be on the receiving end and you put something out that you have a challenge and you really need help, your community will respond, and then you'll really appreciate that you belong.
For listeners who want to learn more about you or get in contact, what can they do?
Go to smashingtheplateau.com. We have our podcast, which we're releasing episodes weekly. And we also have on our website all of the episodes we've ever produced. So you can get, at this point, it's over 800 episodes going back almost 10 years. They're all there. The good, the bad, and the ugly, that's free. We have a newsletter that comes out every weekday, so 5 issues per week. I try to keep them short and helpful. So it's mostly, you know, stories and strategies that deal with all the things we've talked about in this episode. That's also free. And then we have information about our community, which is, it's a paid membership, but that's there as well. We do have periodic workshops. We're going to be most likely running these workshops. You could sign up for just one to get a taste of what this is all about, as opposed to just joining the whole community. So they happen periodically, and they're listed on the website as well.
And how does that community work?
So it's an online platform that's private. So in order to communicate with other members through the platform, you need to log in. So it's not on social media. It's not a Facebook group. This is, a private membership site. And then we have live events that are a combination of helping members go through the process I described to make sure that their goals are clear, they have short-term objectives that are achievable, and then we have sessions where members talk about what they're working on, get feedback from other members. So that's the sort of the goal setting and accountability portion. Then we have learning sessions on topics that are important. So we have one coming up shortly that's going to be about personal branding. We have another one coming up on what are the most important financial metrics and strategies to use for a consulting or coaching business. We had one on storytelling. Storytelling is really important for marketing and sales. So yeah, so a lot of learning sessions as well.
That sounds really good. Anyway, thank you for joining me today.
My pleasure, Genevieve. Thank you for asking me.
And for those in the audience, thank you for listening. I'm Dr. Genevieve Hayes, and this has been Value-Driven Data Science, brought to you by Genevieve Hayes Consulting.